for The Perfect Scam. I'm your host, Michelle Kosinski.
And I'm Frank Abagnale.
Frank has played a doctor, a lawyer, a pilot, and now he's playing a podcast host. He joins me, along with other top fraud experts, to share some of America's biggest scam stories.
Somebody's always going to be trying to come up with a new scheme. It's just too much money to be made easily.
Frauds, scams, con artists, shocking tales of deceit. You name it, we got it all. The Perfect Scam from AARP.
Welcome to Our House, the only complete on-air resource for your home ownership needs. Now, here's the host of Our House, Peter Hunt.
Good morning and welcome to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and this show is brought to you by the continuously revamped huntrealestate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and home ownership experience. This show is huntrealestate.com is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA here in Buffalo, Niagara, all across upstate. And even out to Phoenix, Arizona. It's also powered by our newest affiliate in the Massachusetts marketplace, and that is ERA Key Real Estate. And that's, I'll come back to that in a second, because that's part of our, I think, a very interesting element of our show this morning. The show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage. Call them today, 633-3700, and ask one of our skilled mortgage consultants to work with you to find the lowest rate and closing costs for your particular home financing needs and wants. And also ask about our many exclusive programs, including our pre-purchase commitment that allows you at no cost or risk to effectively enter the market to find your next home with cash. Call today, 633-3700, for personalized, customized service that will knock your socks off. And check out that low rate guarantee. Don't forget about the first ever 24/7, 365 real estate hotline, the Hunt Hotline, which gives you access to all available information about any property listed for sale all across upstate and even out to Phoenix, Arizona. All you have to do is dial 716-631-4800. That's the local number here in Western New York. Enter the street number of the house you want to know about, no matter whose listing it is. The hotline will prompt you with a choice of street name. Select the one you want. You'll hear a brief description, and then you'll be texted a link to a dedicated website on that property, all automatically and just that fast on any property. Anywhere we serve on any listing, whether it's ours or any other brokers. So please keep that in mind. This is a very active time in the market, believe it or not, and it's springtime generally is, but obviously we have unusual circumstances in our world today, which makes it a little more difficult for you to actually physically look at a house yourself. But through technology, we've changed all that, and I encourage you to contact one of our Hunt Real Estate ERA professionals today. 633-9400 will access all that for you. Hunt Real Estate is the official real estate and relocation provider for our hometown professional teams, the Buffalo Bills, the Buffalo Sabres, and the Rochester Americans, all of whom are sitting on the sidelines for a while as we go through what we're going through here in New York State and also across the nation. We are live on WBEN 930 AM, and if you'd like to participate in today's show, you can reach us here in the studio at 716-803-0930 or 1-800-616-9236 if you're long distance, and star 930 if you're mobile, and those are all free calls. And don't forget, if you travel outside of our area and you want to still listen into the show, it's WBEN.com, as we're live every day, every Saturday on that website. And also you can reach us by text at 30930 if you've got a question that you'd like to ask about anything relative to real estate or what my guest today has to address, which is a very important topic. My guest today, it's a little bit different kind of show today. My guest, a very special show. My guest today is from Massachusetts. His name is Brian Davis. Mr. Davis is a real estate professional, but he's got a very interesting background, which he'll tell you about. And he also has family that are participating actively at the forefront of the whole, I guess, defense against the pandemic that we're experiencing, COVID-19 pandemic. And I'll let him introduce himself, but welcome, Brian Davis. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Peter. Hope all's well there. We woke up to 4 inches of snow here in the Worcester area, Worcester, Massachusetts, central Massachusetts.
Wow.
Nice spring storm. So it looks very nice out there, actually.
I bet it's beautiful. We had 4 straight days with snow here, so maybe it's just drifting its way towards you. Brian Davis, you've been in the business for a while, and you are actually operating one of our offices in Auburn, Mass. Tell us a little about your background, though. You didn't start in real estate. How did you arrive in the real estate industry?
I started right from college. I started teaching, Peter. I started teaching in a high school, Leicester High School, right outside of Worcester, Mass. I had a 36-year career there. I ended up as an assistant principal at the middle school, but for most of my years there, I was a science teacher. I taught most of the sciences. I started generally with biology. I taught earth science, astronomy. I also taught microbiology, which lends me to have an interest in what's going on in today's world. So as a scientist who is out there teaching, I try to stay aware of what's going on, what's happening. And after I did that, I retired. And when I retired, I kind of did work around the house. My wife told me, Brian, why don't you get everything you let go for 36 years? I'd like you to take care of the kids coming here for Christmas. We can have the house all fixed up. So I worked around the house for 6 months every day, get up, do some work, had lunch, did some more work, made supper, kind of like Groundhog Day. And after about 6 months, I decided that I had to do something different. So I had my real estate license, and I went around to many different agencies. And finally, I met up with Cheryl Taylor, who was working as the temporary branch manager out in Worcester. And I talked to her. I really liked what she had to say, very honest up front. And so I signed on with the RA key, and I did that in February of 2011. And I worked as an agent for approximately, I think it's been about four or five years. And then the branch manager position in Auburn opened up, and Cheryl, Jeff, Bruce, they're all very nice. Maybe they had a lapse there for a minute, but they hired me on as the branch manager, and I've been in Auburn for about 4 years now, three, 4 years. And it's just been great. Wonderful, wonderful place. All the ERA key branches are great, but you know, Auburn, I particularly like the branch there. The people there are fantastic, and like I said, the leadership that we have now is fantastic. So it's been really good. I absolutely have no regrets. I know I signed on with the right agency, and it's just been fantastic, Brian.
Well, I know from speaking with Cheryl and Jeff Taylor that they also agree that they made no mistake either, that bringing you into the organization was a wonderful thing for the organization, or what we're glad you're with us. I want to go back to your experience with microbiology and science as a teacher. And as you look at the situation, and you know you have a very particular perspective because of what your wife does and also two of your children. So perhaps you could explain to us a little bit about how you're looking at it from that perspective, as well as, and we'll talk about the real estate perspective in a second, but let's start with your experience as a microbiologist. Tell me about how you see things right now.
Well, as a microbiologist, I used to do a lot with the students, and between bacteria and viruses, they are very, very unpredictable, and they're so adaptable, unpredictable. Viruses are some of the simplest things on Earth, and yet they can cause havoc as we're seeing now. The thing that scares me the most is the fact that we do not know about this virus in particular. Not only do we not know about it, we don't know how it's going to adapt and change, which they are so good at. Just the jump from, in China, the jump from animal to human so quickly like that just shows what they can do. So our unknown factors, whenever it comes to any sort of microbiological organisms, the unknown factors are the things that are really scary. And viruses are even more so. They are, because we don't have as well as a control on the viruses as we do on, say, bacteria, where we have a ton of antibiotics. Even though bacterial resistance is a huge factor, which is something we're going to be facing, I always used to tell my students, one thing that you guys are going to be facing is bacterial resistance to antibiotics, because it's a race that at some point we are going to probably be behind in, and when that happens, it's going to be another pandemic. But the viruses, it's almost the same thing. The viruses adapt and move quickly, and they do so more quickly than we can keep up with, as we're seeing right now. And when you have an unknown virus like this, it's even worse. Until we get a vaccine, we're going to be behind the eight ball. So I always stress that to the students, and I, after working and seeing how the bacteria and viruses operate, it's very scary. It really is. And it's something that we are going to be facing from now on. And, you know, we really have in the past, too. History has shown the pandemics that we've had in the past. You know, the flu, the Asian flu, the swine flu, all the pandemics we've had in the past have shown that it's a huge concern for us.
You know, Brian, it's very interesting what you say. And I happen to be, I was on the board of a health insurer for 12 years, and I learned a lot. I realized how much I didn't know. And it's obviously the field of medicine and biology is massive, and as you indicate, it's constantly changing, and it's very difficult to really, as a layman, to understand what's going on there, much less as a student and a teacher as you are. But as you look at this, and going back to, let's say, the flu, and I don't want to draw a comparison, but when I was on that board, we studied a little bit about the flu vaccinations, and I was told at that time by medical practitioners that the flu vaccine was only effective between 20% and 40% of the time, and that's because we're, just as you indicated earlier, we're kind of chasing our tail. The flu virus this year will be different from last year, and that one different from the year before, so I was told.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we stay ahead of something like COVID-19 going forward? Let's assume a year from now we have a vaccine, which is about what people are saying it's going to take, sometime perhaps as early as you know, January of 2021. But who knows when that will actually be widespread. But how do we stay ahead of any virus?
Well, the flu, what happens, the flu is not just one simple thing. That's what a lot of people think. I'd more think of it like if you took, say, 50 rubber bands and you tied them all together and made them into a ball, those rubber bands make up different RNAs of that flu. So what happens is you get that ball this year of 50 rubber bands. The next year, 5 or 10 of those have changed. They're different rubber bands. So what happens is that your vaccine that was effective this year is not going to be as effective next year because you have a whole different sequence of RNA. And so you have to develop and change your vaccine to suit that year's flu. And then the following year, it changes again. So you're constantly trying to keep up with the change that virus makes. Now, with the COVID, because we had nothing like this, the COVID is very different than the flu virus. A lot of people were saying when it first came out, oh, it's just the flu virus, it's just the cold virus, there's nothing different, H1N1 virus. But it's a totally different virus. It's in a class all by itself. Because of that, we do not have any vaccines that are capable of handling it right now at this point. It's a whole brand new ball of rubber bands, so to speak. And the difference between them is that the when you talk about viruses and you talk about the case fatality rate, CFR,
mm-hmm.
how many fatalities does this virus cause? And something like the flu, you got maybe 1.3 infection rate of maybe 2%. With the COVID, you're up to maybe between 1% and 3.4% fatality rate. So with the flu, you have like a 0.1. With the COVID, you have between 1% and 3.4% fatality rate. So the CFR for this is totally, totally different than it is for the flu virus. And the hospitalization rate is much greater for this also. For the flu, the hospitalization rate was about 2%. For this, it's about 19%. So it's a totally different virus that we have not had any contact with before. And that's why it's going to take so long to come up with a vaccine. It's just a whole new one. We've had permutations of the flu virus, so we can handle that. But when you have something new come onto the scene, it's a whole new ballgame. That's why it's going to take, like, I hope, Peter, you are right. I hope by January we have a vaccine, because until we have a vaccine, this is going to be sticking around. We're not going to be able to get rid of it.
What's interesting, one of the things that I've been studying for, I guess, so I can keep our people informed, is all the massive news that you're getting about this particular issue, COVID-19, and how it's affecting not just our physical condition, but obviously the economic conditions in our country today, which are quickly deteriorating, as we learned this week, in terms of unemployment. One of the things, though, that strikes me, and I'd like your comments on this as a scientist, in Erie County, for example, there's been obviously a number of deaths, but almost half of those deaths were in nursing homes, and or people that were already under some kind of care in one way, shape, or form. And most of those people, the vast majority of those people, had significant underlying conditions. So to what extent can we attribute all the deaths, the percentage that you're talking about, strictly to COVID-19, or is that just an accelerator? Does that take already bad conditions and make them far worse?
Well, it's obviously it has hit different segments of the population differently, just the way that it's hit different countries differently. Italy, with the CFR, the case fatality rate is extremely high. They have a greater number of elderly population there, and that probably did play a role. But the other problem that we have is the reporting. China, South Korea, all the countries that have been reporting, we don't feel that the reports are really accurate because of the fact that the number of cases are not all reported. A lot of people who may have it do not report in as having it. And we don't feel that the number of deaths is always can be attributed to this. There could be other causes, and sometimes they get reported as COVID-19. But there's also, they feel that there's a lot of non-reporting of COVID-19 deaths. So it seems as though the statistics could be skewed quite a bit either way. And it's a result of the reporting not being accurate enough, no matter what country you're looking at, even here in this country, although it does seem to be skewed a little more to people who have underlying conditions. It still is not accurate enough reporting here in the U.S. as of yet.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at that. I know the scientists are looking at that, and it's really trying to get worldwide, the World Health Organization is really trying to compile a lot better statistics on just exactly who is being affected by this and why there is such a difference. But it still doesn't, there's still a lot of people. They were saying that it affected the age groups differently, but it's still affecting. People can be in their 30s, 20s, be in perfect health, and they can still come down and crash very quickly and unfortunately end up succumbing to it. So there is no real set rule. It's kind of a wild card out there.
Mm-hmm.
People out there say, oh, I'm in great health, I'm in my 30s, this isn't going to affect me, and they could end up being on a ventilator. And there's people who are in their 90s who have survived, and people who are in their 80s and 90s who don't get it. So mm-hmm. really very, very tough to say that it's really affecting one population or one segment of the population more, although it does seem as though there are some trends, definitely.
Well, it definitely statistically is skewed towards the elderly and those that have underlying conditions. But and as you accurately point out, the statistics are moving all the time, and every day those ratios that you're talking about, 1%, 2%, 3%, keep changing because we're testing more, we're finding out who has had it through the antibody tests, and also we're finding out who does have it now. But here, for example, in this part of the country, we're only limiting the test for the condition itself, for the virus itself, to those people that have symptoms. So it's been very difficult to really gauge how widespread this is, and I'm sure you're sensitive to that. But I want to just kind of shift gears a little bit on this, because you have family directly involved on the front line, and at our company right now, we're looking through our company to find out who the heroes are inside our company that are helping to arrest this situation and deal with the cases as they come up. Tell us a little about your family.
Well, let's see. Where should I start? My wife has been a nurse for, a long time now, 40, 50 years, 40 years, I think. And right now she is vice president of patient safety and regulatory at a small hospital in this area. And she does not have she's not working directly with the patient, but at her hospital, she's one of two people in the command center. She's basically been working almost 24/7 for a good month now. And what she does is she kind of oversees things as the patients come in, as the staff needs things. They call the command center and they do their best to make sure that they get supplies, that any need is met, any problem that comes up, and there's quite a few things that can come in that are problematic. So she is kind of running that aspect of the hospital, and It's been a real grind. It really has. They're, I would say that from everything I hear, they're just running on all four cylinders. And it's just been a very, very hectic and very trying month here, at least, if not 5 weeks. So she was the nurse. And then my older daughter became a nurse. And when she graduated from college, she got a job working as a nurse. She's now a nurse practitioner. And she normally works as a nurse practitioner in an ambulatory surgical setting, but she was redeployed a couple weeks ago to a metropolitan hospital in Boston, and she's working as a bedside nurse on a COVID-19 floor. She has moved out of her house. She has twins, my granddaughters, who are 10 years old, but she does not want to come home and be in contact with them or her husband, so she is living with a friend, and she goes in, and she says it's just they have had to take other floors, convert them to COVID-19 floors. And she said it's just basically like a war zone, is the way she put it. She also said, you know, I did a little research because she was talking. One of the big things is the ventilators, the ventilator issue. Mm-hmm. A little research on the ventilator issue. I didn't really know that much about ventilators. But what I found out was there's a few things here. You don't just put someone on a ventilator and walk away. Ventilators are very resource intensive. So in other words, when you put someone on a ventilator, you have to have respiratory therapists that are constantly monitoring it. It's almost a 24-hour-a-day job. You can't just walk away. Because when a patient's on a ventilator, you have to continually tweak it to make sure that the patient is getting the optimal effects from that ventilator. Now, I never knew that. I basically thought if someone was on a vent, you just kind of walked away and they'd just stay on it. But that's not the case. So a lot of times when we're talking about ventilators and the resources, we're also talking about the human resources. We don't have enough respiratory therapists. What happens is she says that the intercom is continually beeping, giving the call for respiratory therapists to report to this room or that room. And because of the fact we don't have enough personnel and because of the fact that they're so resource intensive, that's one of the problems. The other problem is if something happens in a room, someone codes or someone goes downhill, personnel can't just rush into the room. They have to don the protective gear before they go in, no matter what's going on. And so that takes some time to get all the protective gear on. And it gets very, very time-consuming when you have three or four medical personnel trying to don protective gear before they can even enter the room. And so with what's going on now, with a lot of the people crashing, it's very, very hard on the staff because
Brian, I have to stop right there. We have to go to a break, but I want to hold that thought and come back to it. It's extremely important. We'll be right back with more from Our House to Yours after these important messages. Welcome back to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and the show is brought to you by the all-new HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and home ownership experience. HuntRealEstate.com is the only place on the web where you can find a complete inventory of homes available, not just here in Buffalo, Niagara, but all across upstate and through our links even out to Phoenix, Arizona. You'll also find access to a complete set of home ownership services at HuntRealEstate.com, which is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA. The show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, and for more information about our exclusive programs, including the one that allows you to effectively buy the before and live the after by rolling the costs of home improvements into your mortgage and knowing exactly what you're going to be in for, which is a big deal in a place like upstate New York, where you've got a significant amount of houses that have been built quite a while ago and beautiful woodwork and lovely settings. But the unfortunate thing is you never know what you're getting into until you get into there, and this program allows you to know all that. 633-3700 to learn about that and other programs, including the pre-purchase commitment and even our warm home loan. And don't forget about that second look program, one of the best things that our president, Linda Malia, has ever come up with. What you can do there is very simply, if you've been qualified for a loan someplace else or even have a piece of paper that says that, you know, you're committed for X number of dollars at some other lending institution, let us take a look at it. That's called a second look program. And if we will either beat it or match it, and if we can't, we're going to give you a gift certificate. We'll give you a gift certificate anyway. All you have to do is dial 633-3700 and ask that we take a second look on your behalf. We have a very special show for you today. On live remote today is a gentleman named Brian Davis. Mr. Davis is a real estate professional in central Massachusetts. He lives in Worcester, and he's practicing as a branch director for ERA Key, which is part of the Hunt Real Estate ERA organization, and that he leads that office in Auburn, Massachusetts for us. And he's been a very interesting perspective on this whole situation we're dealing with, both from a real estate and a healthcare standpoint, based on not just his own experience, but the experience of his family members as well. And the reason why Brian is with us today is that each periodically I'm issuing memoranda to our company so that they can be kept abreast of what's going on from a governmental standpoint relative to our industry, as well as a health perspective, given what I am able to glean from what's going on around us in this COVID-19 pandemic. And Brian sent me a very thoughtful response to one of our memos, and through that we got engaged in a little, first of all, an email dialogue, and then on the phone yesterday. And I invited him on the show today because, not just because of his own real estate perspective, but because of the perspective of his family members and his own background as a scientist. And so Brian is with us from Massachusetts today. And Brian, you were, before the break, you were just about to tell us a little bit more about the conditions under which your daughter in particular is working at Mass General. Can you elaborate a little bit more for us, please?
Yeah, sure. So like I say, you know, the donning of the equipment and being safeguarded, making sure that they are safeguarded, it's vitally important. The other thing is that some hospitals have negative pressure rooms where they're putting the patients in. Negative pressure means that nothing can get out of the room. The pressure inside the room is lower so that nothing can escape. But, you know, the hospital she's at, they don't have those. So, in effect, the virus is able to spread easier. So they have to take more precautions even when they're not in rooms. So the situation is always one, you know, they're constantly worried, constantly, of course, most of the hospital workers there have families. Can you even go home? A lot of them, they go home, they take their clothes off and immediately go to the shower. And so a lot of them are almost more afraid for their families than they are for themselves. And so the work they're doing is truly just heroic. It really is. I'm sure you see it on the TV, and it's absolutely true what they are doing. Because, you know, I say to a lot of the people who say, well, you know, it's not that bad. It really isn't, you know, it's really not more than a cold or anything. I say, well, you know what, I tell you what, why don't you go volunteer in one of the hospitals? And I'd like to see how many folks would do that. So it's really everything that is on TV and talking about what they're doing is true.
You know, you're exactly right. And unfortunately, we're not seeing enough on TV. We're seeing a lot of political, I guess the politicians are kind of taking up the airspace as well as the visuals on television these days. And it's hard to get the kind of information that you're providing for us here today, Brian. I appreciate that very much. We do have a couple of callers on the line. Brian, I'd like you to join me in responding. Our first one is Gustav from Williamsville, New York. Gustav, how can we help you?
Thank you. I was wondering if your guest has any opinion about, the political and epidemiological discussion going on with the World Health Organization, the Chinese, the Gates Foundations, and the vaccine search, the commercialization of it, versus some of the shorter-term treatments that the president has suggested, which have been pushed back against by press and various things.
That's a lot of stuff. Well, I think Brian gets the gist. Brian, I don't know where to start with that.
I know
that's a lot.
Good. You know, in regards to the World Health Organization, I think everyone was caught a little bit short-sighted here, and I think it just seems to me that the world as a whole, we've become reactive. We weren't proactive enough with this. And I think that that's showing up here now. In regards to, you know, politicians using it to advance their positions, of course, that's going to happen and that will happen. It's expected. That's how the job runs. But I think the thing that you have to look at is you have to sort through it yourself. You have to say, okay, what's right for me? What should I be doing at this time? And I think that's the thing that's the most important. And so you take a look at everything, you weigh what is happening, you try to be as informed as possible. And in this case, we're talking about measures that we're looking at to reopen this country. And I think that, you know, in some cases, it's going to be, it's not an easy question. There's going to be people who say, yeah, I definitely want to get back. I think there's going to be a lot of people who, even when the country is fully open, they're going to be very hesitant to go back to work. I think that's going to be another factor that we don't even take a look at.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be many people who say, I am not going back now, even though the all clear has been sounded. And in some regards, they're probably right. Until there's a vaccine, I don't think there's going to be a total all clear. And no matter if you do it in 3 stages, 5 stages, 7 stages, I don't think that it's not going to put an end to this problem. It's going to either delay it or it's going to just have it come back even worse. And that's another scenario that I don't even want to think about.
Well, that is the dilemma of the day, in my opinion, because if we wait, let's say we stay under lockdown throughout the country pretty much until there's a vaccine, our economy will collapse. There's no question about that. We cannot continue. The government can't prop up this economy enough. It's a very, very, it's a huge economy, and it's a very dynamic economy that relies on people being employed and contributing to the productivity of the entire society. And without that, you know, we're sitting at home basically on our thumbs trying to wait for the all clear sign, as you indicated. But, you know, that becomes a political discussion, and we're seeing all sides of that. In New York State, we've got our version of it. Massachusetts, you've got yours. And I'd like to shift gears just a little bit, because you are deep into it in the real estates from the real estate perspective as well. But there's a different set of rules in Massachusetts than there are in New York State. You actually can do many of the things that we were doing before. Tell us what it's like to operate in the real estate business under the guidelines that the state of Massachusetts is providing.
Well, it's definitely a lot different. You know, I think there's more best practices, and what they say is that they're encouraging us to work as remotely as much as possible, limit the in-person interactions as much as possible, to do virtual tours, and to use photos, videos as much as possible as you can. It comes down to the fact that because it's almost up to the individual practitioners, so they have to decide to what level are they going to be marketing a house, or what level are they going to be interacting with their buyers of a house. And so they have to decide how they're going to do it. But if you're working with a seller who says, okay, I don't mind working with you, going to see houses, now you have to deal with the sellers who say, well, I don't know if I want people coming into my house. And so we have to make those arrangements, and we have to talk about that with not only your clients, but also the clients of the co-broker. So it has changed the scene here in Massachusetts tremendously. We here in Worcester, they have banned open houses in the city.
Mm-hmm.
Other communities, though, have not banned open houses. So it's not the same across the board. We do have differences. And, you know, we don't, it's a little bit different for everybody. And so you have to check out and make sure that you know the turf before you enter.
That really puts a great deal of additional stress on each individual real estate professional then in that environment, because you've got to make a determination on every single showing, on every single house. And the client, the seller of the home, can be making a different set of decisions effectively for you, so that changes everything again. So it's how do you find... How has that affected sales, Brian? How do you see things? Are people just saying, well, I'll just wait till this is over? Or are they saying, you know what, I'm willing to take whatever chance. Maybe this is an opportunity. We did a show last week on what it was like here in Western New York, and we had a team on that really quite effectively argued for the opportunity in times like these, when there might be less competition for each individual listing, and we do have a shortage of inventory throughout the entire country. So how do you see that from that perspective, Brian?
Well, all the sales are down, obviously, but this is a time for opportunity. We had an agent who put a house on last weekend and had 40 showings signed up for. He was spacing them out so that they only had 15 minutes each to come in, but there were 40 groups that wanted to come and take a look at that property.
Wow.
Obviously, there is movement, there is sales, but it is depressed, definitely, say, from this time last year. And I think a lot of people, I think you're right, and that a lot of people are saying, okay, you know, we'll wait till this kind of is over. But also, the other thing is that the predictions are that quarter one and quarter two were really down, but they're saying that the home sales in quarter three and four are going to make up for it. And so, if that is the case, then I think people are there, they're going to be ready to go. And if things improve by August, September, then I think that they're going to definitely jump either whether to buy or sell.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that the predictions are correct, but a lot of it, I think, with this whole coronavirus, a lot of it is you cannot make predictions. You cannot say, oh, this state we're going to reopen. This state home sales are going to increase. This state people are going to be out and about.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a let's wait and see and play it as it comes. Let's see what's going on. And so predictions, I think, with this are very, very difficult to make.
We have to go to a break, Brian, but we'll be back with more from Brian with Brian Davis from Worcester, Mass. After these very important messages from our host to yours. Welcome back to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and this show is brought to you by the continuously revamped HuntRealEstate.com, and also this show is brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, the home of the low rate and closing cost guarantee and the pre-purchase commitment. I encourage you to call them today, 633-3700. We're in the midst of a very special show for you today, which is centered around the kind of the intersection between the COVID-19 pandemic and the real estate market. And we're just about to get into a little bit more about that with a gentleman named Brian Davis, who is coming to us from Worcester, Mass. But before we get to that, Brian, we have a caller on the line. This is John from Rochester. John, how can we help you?
Hey, Peter. Hey, Brian. Brian, I got a couple of questions for you. Number one, I think the denominator is the key to the real death rate. And that's clearly not been established yet, this virus. I think you mentioned their death rate's about 1.1% versus the flu, which is 0.1%. But the denominator, I think, is the key. They haven't established that, I don't think, truly, because there's a lot of people out there that have been affected that don't know about it and aren't on record. My other point is I heard a doctor on one of the television broadcasts. He brought out an interesting point. California has a very low rate right now. And his theory was that they actually had their epidemic back in the summertime in the fall and developed herd immunity. And that's one of the reasons that the programs that are being done today might be a failure because we're not going through natural herd immunity. What do you think?
Well, that's a good point. My younger daughter, who actually, I didn't mention her, she's a physician assistant at Dana-Farber in Boston, but she is on maternity leave until the 7th of May when she will have to go back to work. So she from home has been sending me articles, and I believe, I'd have to relook, but I think they did a study, and they do not think that the virus was present in California. I have to relook at that, though. But according to your herd immunity theory, yes, they say that until 60% of the population was infected, that's when the herd immunity would kick in. In other words, if 60% of the population was infected and either survived or got over it, when 60% of the population is infected, then you would have what's called herd immunity, which means that the virus would not be as rampant as it is now. So the thing is, are we trying to suppress it by isolation, and then when everyone comes out, it's going to come back, and eventually we're going to hit that 60%, or is what we're doing working, and hopefully we can continue this until we get a vaccine? So, yes, herd immunity is a huge factor in this whole equation.
You know, that's a very, very interesting observation that John made, and I hadn't heard that about California. And it's also equally interesting how you framed that, Brian, and I truly appreciate that, because that puts a whole new look on this whole thing, in my opinion. I just listened to a report this morning about how some scientists are saying that this has been with us for much longer than we really know right now, and that this kind of goes to the whole theory behind the origin of this in China. How do you feel about that, Brian? Do you think that this is as they say, that it started at Wuhan province and that's where it all began, or is this something that's been lurking out there that maybe we just didn't identify as COVID-19?
I really think it started in Wuhan. I think that's where it began. I could be completely wrong, but I really do think this strain of this virus, I believe, started there in the form that it's in now. I don't think it was here earlier, although I know in February I had a couple of days I wasn't feeling well. I got over it and it lingered for a couple of days. I just thought it was my typical winter cold. Who knows? And if we had testing so I could be tested, then that would become clear whether or not I had it. But I really do not think, and I really wish I could remember my daughter's article that she sent where they did the study that showed that what happened in Seattle and California was not the COVID virus. But I'd have to do a little more looking into that.
Let me ask you a question about the test for the antibody, which is something that some people are saying, which test should come first? Should we just test everybody's temperature when they come in and out of any public place? Should we make sure that everyone in the whole society has a test for the virus, the presence of the virus itself? And or should we be testing people randomly to find out if they've ever had the virus and thus have the immunity in their system? Yesterday, I had a conversation with one of our professionals from Central New York who has a relationship with a friendly relationship with a company in North Carolina that has a test that's been approved by the is it the FDA would approve the test? Is that the right organization, Brian?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. The FDA has apparently approved this test for the antibody, and you can actually, you can either set up a center yourself, provided it meets all the kind of standards of the community, or you can go to their center. And we're contemplating now testing our people to see if they have the immunity built up because they've effectively had the virus at one point in time and thus could come back into work, for example. Do you think that's a viable strategy?
Well, I believe testing for antibodies is. The problem with that is they're starting to question whether or not if you've had it before, if you can't get it again, if the antibody resistance may only last for 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you get a vaccine for, they used to give you a booster shot for polio because once you got the first shot, it did not boost up your antibodies enough, and that's why they called it a booster shot. So you'd get a booster shot later to make sure that your antibody titer, which is the level of antibodies, was high enough so that it would give you protection. So they are questioning now whether or not those folks who had this and have antibodies, if 3 or 4 months later, if it's not starting to come back because maybe the levels of antibodies are enough. I think more important is universal testing. The way that South Korea held this in check was they did contact tracing, in which they isolated everyone who came in contact with anyone who had this. Now, it's a different society in South Korea, obviously. We have a lot different society here than they do. But by doing that, they were able to isolate, contain, and have a much lower fatality rate than we do here. And now we are looking at contact tracing. And just the other day, I had heard about something where if they have a program now on your cell phone so that they can trace, if you come down with this, they can find out who you came in contact with or were near within the last 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and they can work with those people. Now, obviously, there's huge privacy issues with this, and the other thing is that you would have to, if you came down with it, you would have to go onto your phone, and there's an app where you would have to go into the app and say that you had this. And then they could notify all the people. And these are strangers that you pass in the street. Whether or not you know it, your Bluetooth on your phone, every time you pass another phone, it records how far away you were from that person in the date and the time. You probably don't know this.
That's crazy.
It is. It's cuckoo crazy.
Let me just jump back to this whole testing issue for a second, because I happen to agree with you. I think testing is the key, and that comes up every day in some press conference or another. How do you feel about having universal testing at least among the people that are most at risk in society? Our healthcare workers, the first responders, the elderly, there's several categories, but obviously the ones that come to mind. How do you feel about that?
Definitely. As much testing as possible.
But let's say we started there. Through what you say, we begin to isolate those people. And I feel very badly about your daughter who has to go home because of her exposure at Mass General. But there's many people, unfortunately, like your daughter that are coming in contact with us every day. But has your daughter been tested, for example?
No, she has not.
Really? That shocks me to hear that.
Right, but they don't test. They don't do universal testing of all healthcare workers unless they start to have symptoms.
That's the point. I mean, wouldn't it make more sense just to see how it's spreading in an environment like hospital only? And the only way you're going to know that is through testing, unless I'm wrong.
Right. I think the biggest problem right now, believe it or not, is not shortages of ventilators. It's shortages of testing.
Right. Exactly.
Less than 1% of the population in this country has been tested.
Exactly. Well, you know, Brian, I'm going to shift back to real estate here for a second, because I think you brought up from a very knowledgeable standpoint many issues that I know are in the minds of our listeners, and it may affect their interest, for example, in maybe getting in their car and just driving into a neighborhood in their car and just looking around to see where they might want to live. But the next question is, well, how do I get it? Do I even want to go into that house? And you accurately point out that in an environment like Massachusetts right now, you have to make a decision on literally every showing on every single house. Here in New York State, that decision is effectively made for you because of much tighter restrictions. But this has put a damper on the industry. There's no question about it. And the month of April is kind of the depth of the whole thing right now from our perspective in the business. Is that how it is in Massachusetts? Because right up until the end of March, it was pretty much business as usual.
Right. Well, right up until the end of March, it was here also.
I'm speaking about specifically Massachusetts. You were still, you had lesser restrictions than we did. Ours kicked in about the middle of March. But even with that, the number of sales were pretty much business as usual through the end of March in both places. How do you see it? How long do you think this is going to go forward from a realistic standpoint, given all the things you've said today?
I think one thing through all this that I've been very surprised, but the adaptability that we've had to this whole thing has been tremendous. To see what's going on from all aspects of society, restaurants have gone from seating to takeout, how we've used technology now to connect. It's just been the adaptability that we have had. And I believe that in the real estate industry, it's the same thing. We are leaning more on technology. We're leaning more on things like Zoom, virtual showings. So I believe that what's going to happen is we're going to do a little shift to a little more of that. I don't, until this, my own prediction, this is totally my own, until this whole thing is over with and we have a vaccine, I think we're going to be depressed. I think it's going to rebound a bit, and if we do start coming back with the three-step program, I definitely think the real estate will rebound, because this is a huge need. It's a suppressed need right now, so it will come back. I hope it comes back to levels before. I have my doubts, just because I think there's going to be lingering fears on parts of buyers and sellers to do anything, because they don't want exposure. And like I say, I think a big factor in this is going to be the fact that people, there's going to be a huge segment of the population that are still going to be afraid to do anything for quite a while.
Brian Davis, you I think you used a key word there called it, and that was adaptability. And I have to say that of the professionals inside our organization, at least, I've never seen anything like this in terms of their ability and their speed at adapting, as well as their their ease of use with the technology that's now available, and I know you fall into that category. We do have to go, Brian Davis. I want to thank you very much for joining us from Massachusetts today and sharing your insights. They have been extremely valuable, I hope, to me and to everyone listening to this show. We'll be back again next week at the same time. And remember, when it comes to real estate, all of upstate is hunt country.
That's Play With Me in Dog.
A Bite A Wee dog or cat adds a lot of love to your life. Be their hero. Change a life. Theirs and yours. Because love goes two ways.
That's Feed Me in Cat.
Adopt a Bite A Wee dog or cat today. This spring, donate to Bite A Wee and make a difference in the life of a dog or cat in need of a second chance. Visit biteawee.org for more info. Bite A Wee. Finding loving homes for rescued animals since 1903.